This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us on our virtual Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. We're going to start our show today talking about a piece of history, if you will. The Sisters of 77 is an independent lens documentary on a seminal women's conference that was held in Houston, Texas, more than 40 years ago. It remains the only federally funded women's conference in our nation's history. Dr. Christy McGeorge is a professor in the Department of Human Development and Family Science at North Dakota State University. And recently, she interviewed several North Dakota women who served as delegates to that conference. There will be a screening of the documentary and a presentation of the oral histories on Monday, August 13th at NDSU. Today, Ashley Thornburg visited with McGeorge.
Dr. Christy McGeorge, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
What sparked your interest in the Sisters of 77 film?
I've always been interested in women's rights and women's fights for equality. And given that the National Conference in 1977 was the only federally funded conference that the U.S. has ever held on women's rights, when the documentary came out in 2005, I was just so excited to see it because it had been very hard to get original footage. I'd written to the Library of Congress to get some print materials, but had struggled to find original footage.
Wow. So your interest predates the documentary even.
It did. Okay. I actually didn't know the documentary was in progress until it came out, and then it was just a perfect augmentation to my own research.
Okay. And your research, as it relates to the Sisters of 77 conference, you interviewed a number of women from North Dakota who traveled to the conference. How did you contact this woman? What was their reaction? Were people hesitant, overjoyed to talk to you?
Yeah. Initially, I just wanted to put together a full list of who from North Dakota participated in some capacity in the conference. And that's where actually the Library of Congress was very helpful. They helped me put together that list because I couldn't find a record in North Dakota. I contacted the state archives in Bismarck, and they helped me and found some materials on our state conference. But once I got a list, it really was a search because I had to locate all the women because they had moved and gone on to other adventures. As I was able to find them, they were so grateful, which is very different for someone who does research on human subjects. People, when I contact you, you're like, no, thank you. I don't want to participate. But they were so excited that someone even knew that they had done this. And so when I asked them, could I talk to them, they were quick to invite me to their homes. Some of them wanted to come to the university, to my office. But I, along with two others, traveled around the state of North Dakota visiting with these women, and it was just a fabulous adventure.
And so these oral histories or clips from the oral histories will be played in conjunction with a showing of the film, and Sisters of 77 will be playing 6 p.m. on August 13th at NDSU's Family Life Center, and you will be there to facilitate a discussion and play your own audio clips from some of these women. So let's hear about some of the women on here, because one that really stands out to me is a woman named Pauline Howard. She's from Minot. At the time of the conference, she was a deputy sheriff in Ward County. But there's a weird little wrinkle here.
Yeah, it was such a privilege to travel to Minot and meet Pauline at her kitchen table. And as we were learning about her role as a deputy sheriff, she shared with us a really impactful story about how she wanted this new technology had come about. It was called the breathalyzer, and she wanted to be able to use the breathalyzer, but was told that she couldn't, that it was too scientific for a woman to be able to utilize. Pauline, of course, as she tells this
story. I'm trying so hard not to laugh at that, but it sounds so ridiculous now.
It really does. It really does, and gets to some of the real barriers these women experienced, even though they knew they had the ability and they knew they had the passion. And so Pauline ended up suing Ward County to get the right to become, to her knowing, and the best that I can find, this is hard information to locate, the first woman, at least in Ward County, and she really believed maybe in the state of North Dakota to be allowed to use the breathalyzer. And so she just represents some of the amazing women we had who were active throughout the 60s and 70s, really fighting for women's rights and for equality.
And when you spoke to Pauline all these many years later, how does she reflect on that story? You know, was she mad? Did she laugh? Is there sort of, you know?
There's sort of a mix of emotion. It was really just such a neat experience to sit with her. And she there was both some feist to her still and some of that anger, but also she just wondered how – she asked us even, how silly does this sound to you? But to be honest, it didn't sound silly at all. It just sounded brave that she would say, I can do this. You know, I am capable. And so it was just such an honor to hear her and the other women's stories that just can't be lost, to be honest.
And speaking of not losing these will be archived in the regional archives. That's at NDSU, correct?
Yes. Okay. So they will be archived for once I have finished my writing from them, then I want them to be there. All the women gave permission. This was an important part of their legacy, that there be a record of what they had accomplished.
Well, let's talk about another woman and her legacy, Juanita Helfrey. She is from the Fort Berthold Indian Reservation. She's a member of the Hidatsa Nation. And she was fighting the battle of racist mascots. Back then, in the 70s, it has taken years. I mean, even within the state of North Dakota, it's only recently that we've done away with the Fighting Sioux logo, and there are still many franchises that have this today. And this, she was fighting this
and she,
decades ago.
She continued. When we at the time of the interview, she was living in Newtown, and we got to travel to Newtown to be with her. And I think that was an impactful story. She was talking about her time in Cleveland and how she was a part of the group that was challenging the existence of the Cleveland Indians mascot and what an important voice she was in that fight. And it was neat then to be able to research that more online and see her role in that struggle for really fair representation and accurate representation and to end the characterization of a whole group of people. And I think she, like the other women, what I feel like Juanita also represents is that intersectionality that so many of the women had to do. They were certainly fighting for their rights to exist as women, but then you could add another layer on there for some of the women in terms of fighting not only to exist as women, but to exist as women of color and then to exist as Native women.
Right.
There were so many issues that the Conference of 77 helped the women bring to light that they were living. It's not that they didn't know was a struggle, but they were able to bring to light on a national front.
And, you know, we're talking about this conference going back to 1977, but we have a delegate here who was born in the 1896, Agnes Gielen. Tell me about her.
So Agnes was the oldest of the delegates from North Dakota, and I say that with dear respect. She'd been nicknamed the first woman of everything. She was the first, to all accounts that I can find, she was the first mayor who was a woman in North Dakota. She was the first woman who was a state senator. Her first just go on and on. And while I didn't have the privilege to interview her, many of the women told such fond stories and really looked to her for a lot of guidance and how to continue this fight that started often before many of the other women were even born.
Roberta Beale, I love this story. She was a nun.
She was. Roberta, as a young woman, entered the convent and became a nun. And during her time, she realized that she really wanted to marry and have a family, and she ended up leaving the convent, and she did marry and have a family, but also was a really early advocate for domestic violence shelters and rape crisis centers, and started a shelter and crisis center in Dickinson. And the neatest thing for me was we actually got to do her interview there at the shelter and visit her. And to hear all about her efforts related to protecting women from violence, as well, and her efforts went beyond. She did a lot of things around fair housing, homelessness. That's the thing about so many of these women. Why we may not know their stories, they were fighting for so many people and their own rights along the way.
What were some of the main topics at the 77 Women's Conference?
So there was a 26-plank platform is what they called it, and they really ranged. They ranged from issues related to education, to the Equal Rights Amendment, to access to credit cards and credit in your own name, to issues around rape and marital rape. Not all states at the time, my understanding is, had laws that said marital rape was actually a criminal offense, to Title IX concerns, to issues for women of color, to lesbian rights, to reproductive rights and control.
We have taken care of some of these issues. I have my own credit card. My daughter has a credit card. No, it's in my name. What are the issues that we are still fighting for today?
I think there are still struggles, and particularly here in 2018, we're having an important conversation about rape and domestic violence. Those are issues that are far from solved. That's why they also discuss sexual harassment. We continue to discuss sexual harassment today. Issues related to Title IX and how it's applied and our higher education systems are there. Certainly issues of race and racism haven't been solved. Some progress has been made since 77, but are very current issues for us to consider. The Equal Rights Amendment was discussed at the conference, and while we don't – well, there's some conversation still about the Equal Rights Amendment. We certainly have some active dialogue around equal pay for equal work, and that's something that hasn't been achieved. Certainly progress has been made, but we're not there. I think yesterday was the day that African American women reached the point where they made the same amount as a white man. And so those issues are really still relevant. I think what this conference did was bring a lot of these issues to the forefront because of the national attention. And it was a catalyst for change, but this work isn't done. And there's still work that needs to be done here.
Are you watching any of the state's politicians, people who might 40, 50 years from now have their oral histories recorded because of their contributions?
That's a really wonderful question, and I hope that future generations of research – I mean, I think of someone like Josh Boshay, who is so bravely been our first out gay representative or state elected official, to my knowledge. And so I wonder about how that conversation might go on and how we might hopefully continue to talk about women's rights. Kathy Hogan has done a lot of conversations lately about women's rights, around issues around child care and pieces like that. So I think there's a number of local officials that will have interesting stories and be an interesting part of our history who could be lost because of their standing as a woman or a member of a different minority group.
Well, let's go back to 77 at the time of this conference. Like you mentioned, it has been the only federally funded women's conference in our history. It comes on the heels of 1975 being declared the year of the woman. It was a time where, you know, there was a certain wave of feminism going on at the time. But also there were noted critics. Phyllis Schlafly, key among them, traveled down to Houston at the same time as the Women's Conference and led a discussion that had some 15,000 people there who very much believed that there was more to be lost in some of the traditions of women's liberation. They actually wanted to retain sort of that stronger sense of here are the advantages to women being at home. Do you get into that side of this debate?
Most definitely. I think it's an important conversation that Phyllis helped raise. While the women that I interviewed didn't agree with her, her right to disagree was part of what they were fighting for, right? Her right to take a stance. Now, strangely, Phyllis Schlafly herself was a lawyer, a very educated woman, a woman who had worked outside the home. Not that you have to go to school to be educated, but she had that privilege. And I think what the Conference of 77 was about women having choices. And so just because the women participated in the conference didn't mean that some of them didn't make the choice to be at home and raise children and didn't value being at home and raising children, but they wanted all sorts of choices. And they wanted to make what choice was best for them and not have a life based on what was best by society standards. And so there were so many women that were invisible. And this myth that women could stay home and raise children and that was the best option was just that. For most of America, it was a myth because it simply wasn't financially feasible. It wasn't a reality for most of our families. And so since most families then and now need, however they're formed, need all the adults in the home to be working outside the home, we need to facilitate that in a way that's safe, safe from harassment, safe, physically safe, as well as economically equally beneficial, regardless of gender.
I did see an infographic recently that was in today's dollars, so not about 1977, but it said, if you hired a professional to do everything that a stay-at-home parent does, it came to something like $170,000 a year.
Yeah. I mean, there was a conversation recently that I was listening into between two academics about the cost of raising children, and is our model in the U.S. even feasible? And they were looking at European models where you have a year or 2 years of parental leave regardless of your gender when you have a child because they recognize you could go to work, but then you might give 70 to 90% of that income to someone to take care of your child. Now, that still may be a good choice for some people because they need to be out of the home and engage in productive work, but it's not a choice we have here in the U.S.
I want to talk about the work that you do. You are a professor in the Department of Human Development and Family Science at North Dakota State University. You've been there since 2003. And one of your main focuses or interest is the influence of heterosexism and homophobia on clinical practices. Are we talking about why AIDS took so long to be diagnosed and taken seriously? Because we thought if it wasn't happening to straight couples, it wasn't that important.
Well, we could be in some ways. My focus really is on mental health work, and so how homophobia and heterosexism impacts the therapy process, whether that's individual therapy, couple therapy, relational therapy, family therapy, because we can see that clinicians can make a lot of clinical choices even today, even in an age where marriage equality has been passed. Now, we don't know what comes in the future, given some shifts on the Supreme Court level, but where clinicians choose not to work with LGBT couples or families or individuals because of their sexual orientation or gender identity. And that's not acceptable. It doesn't meet the standards of any of our mental health professions' codes of ethics, but yet goes on, not just here, but across our country. And so I've been looking at different ways that homophobia and heterosexism impacts therapists and impacts how they practice with LGBT families and couples, as well as, you know, practices we don't want to talk about, like reparative or conversion therapy, and how that still goes on both in our community and across our country, even though more and more states are outlawing it, at least for minors.
So what is the work that you are doing? Are you when you talk about researching this,
yeah,
how do you even start that process?
So I collect data from three primary samples. Clinicians themselves, people out there working across both in North Dakota and across the country. I collect data from students who are learning to be clinicians because there's where our profession is going. And I collect data from faculty members who are training students because what information our future clinicians get, they're the gatekeepers to it. And so those are the three populations that I'm researching right now and learning about how they are or are not teaching LGBT affirmative therapy, or how they are learning about LGBT affirmative practices, which involves both embracing marginalized sexual orientations and gender identities, as well as celebrating them. I think as a clinical disciplines, we need to move far beyond tolerance because of our ability to do so much damage and on the historic damage we've done to these communities.
What do you mean by far beyond tolerance?
I think for a long time we would say, well, I tolerate you, Ashley. You may have blonde hair, she does, but I tolerate that. But that doesn't work because what am I really communicating to you? What I need to communicate to every client that sits in front of me is that I accept you. I accept you as you are, and I celebrate you. It's not just – it's a beyond tolerate because tolerate is like it's okay, but it's not really okay. And that's where I think we were as a mental health discipline for many years. And we had to move beyond that to figuring out how we move to acceptance. Because we never sit with, let's say, a heterosexual couple and say, I tolerate your couplehood. But what we do instead is when a heterosexual couple, let's say they come in newly engaged, we celebrate it. We ooh and aah over them, even as clinicians.
It's a multi-billion-dollar industry when people get married.
And it need, and that same experience needs to be had by everyone in celebration of who they love and not in saying some people who some folks love is okay and who some folks love just isn't acceptable.
Christy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Christy McGeorge, a professor in the Department of Human Development and Family Science at North Dakota State University. She was speaking with our Ashley Thornburg. The Sisters of 77 screening and discussion will be at 6 p.m. on Monday at NDSU's Family Life Center. Coming up on Main Street, Mark Trahant.
Programming is supported by Basin Electric Power Cooperative of Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy Cooperative. Touchstone Energy Cooperatives comprise a nationwide network of more than 749 Touchstone Cooperative consumer-owned utilities dedicated to innovation, integrity, and commitment to community.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Mark Trahant is the editor of Indian Country Today and the author of the blog Trahant Reports, which looks at current affairs through a Native American lens. Today, Mark takes aim at party politics and efforts to, as politicians often say, get things done.
The Senate is returning to what's called regular order. In that process, a spending bill works its way through committee, is passed by the Senate, and then the House does the same thing. The two bills are resolved, and they're sent to the president. Textbook. Last week, at a Senate news conference, Leader Mitch McConnell, a Republican from Kentucky, said he had reached a deal with Democrats to move forward with 90% of the federal budget, including appropriations bills for defense, health and human services, and the Department of Labor. McConnell's goal is to move 90% of the appropriations bills this way, and the Senate will be completed by Labor Day. Then McConnell hopes the House will move quickly too, so common ground can be found before the fiscal year ends on September 30th. The Interior Appropriations Bill that includes the Indian Health Service and the Bureau of Indian Affairs are included in this regular order process. As part of the deal, Republicans have agreed to avoid policy riders that it would make it impossible to round up votes from Democrats. Remember, it takes 60 votes in the Senate for legislation to be passed. That's the governing part, or in the language of Washington, regular order. The House leadership would very much like to do something similar. House Speaker Paul Ryan, a Republican from Wisconsin, said the House could pass several spending bills before the deadline. But he added, quote, there will be some bills that don't pass, and it's likely a short-term, continuing resolution will be needed. One such bill that will be controversial is the House's plan to spend $5 billion on Homeland Security. The Senate spends far less, only $1.6 billion. As well as a requirement that funds can only be used to reinforce existing physical barriers. Democrats such as Patrick Leahy of Vermont call the House bill a non-starter. This is where the governing part gets confusing. While McConnell and Ryan are championing the regular order and a functioning Congress, the President of the United States is saying something else. President Donald J. Trump last week said several times that Congress must pass funding for a border wall or the government will be shut down. He said he may have to do some pretty drastic things. No matter what budget comes out of Congress, the House version or the Senate plan, the president will still have to sign the legislation into law. Most likely, that will be in the form of a compromise bill. That includes either spending the president does not like or less money than he would like for his border enforcement. So it will be up to the president to close the government without any help from Congress. I'm Mark Trahant.
You can read Mark's blog commentaries at TrahantReports.com. Coming up on Main Street, we'll return to August the Deuce, Mountain North Dakota's annual Icelandic festival, and we'll share a Natural North Dakota essay about the Perseid meteor shower. Time now for the news with Todd.
In the current school year, the share of funding for K-12 education has dropped a bit.
Last time I ran the numbers for the 17-18, it was about 75% state, 25% local and other local in lieu of revenue.
Adam Tesher is Director of School Finance and Organization for the Department of Public Instruction. The 2017 legislature did not increase state aid to schools, but it held it steady, while other agencies were reducing budgets. But Tesher told the legislature's Interim Education Funding Committee locals' costs for schools still went up.
It did get up to about 80% state and 20% local. That's as high as I saw it. But as we flattened out that payment, property taxes have still increased and brought it back down to that 75-25%.
Tesher projects the cost to continue to hold per pupil funding at $9,626 per student in the next biennium would be another $60 million. That's based on a projected growth of 3,000 students in the 2019-2020 school year and 3,300 in the second year of the biennium. The state now spends about $2 billion over a two-year period on elementary and secondary education. A Stutzman County deputy who made arrests in two large drug busts where charges were dismissed has resigned. Sheriff Chad Kaiser says Matt Tom's resignation indicated he was quitting for personal reasons and that he was looking for employment outside law enforcement. Tom had been with the Sheriff's Department for nearly 6 years and was a sergeant. He came to the department after a stint with the Marine Corps. Kaiser says he doesn't know whether recent decisions to drop charges in the drug cases contributed to Tom's decision to resign. The drug bust in December and January on I-94 resulted in four arrests and the seizure of nearly 700 pounds of marijuana. Last week, the state's attorney decided to drop charges at the request of the sheriff's office after determining there were issues with one of the cases. Last month, a judge dropped charges in the other case, ruling evidence in the bust was inadmissible. The sheriff says he's disheartened by the dismissals, but he says we'll learn from our mistakes. For Prairie Public, I'm Todd McDonald.
Hey, do you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question? It's easy to contact us. You can email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or on Facebook, we're Main Street at Prairie Public. Or you can call us toll-free, 888-755-6377. We want to hear from you.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Tom Ezern's voice is a weekly attraction on Main Street. He's a distinguished professor of history at NDSU and a prolific writer. Among his writing projects, the Plainsfolk essays you hear on our show. Today, Tom talks about Mountain North Dakota's annual festival to celebrate its Icelandic heritage, August the Deuce.
One of the nice things about North Dakota is that you can drive 3 hours across the state to see a parade in a town of less than 100 population, and when you get there, you find people you know everywhere. I'm talking about Mountain, North Dakota, site of the annual August the Deuce Festival. We had just settled in alongside some old friends in one of the grandstands when here came Ashley Thornburg of Prairie Public Radio recounting her plot, eventually successful, to score an interview with the Prime Minister of Iceland, Katrin Jakobsdóttir. Her Excellency the Prime Minister, I confess, was the chief reason we had come to Mountain. But as usual with such expectations, so many interesting things turned up. Parade time approached, as did the procession, when into the middle of the street strode a middle-aged guy wearing a red T-shirt and carrying a trumpet. His was the most stirring rendition of our national anthem I have heard in a long time. The parade was full of all the kitschy stuff you would expect, your tractors and your politicians and your faux Vikings. The crowd favorite was the Kim Shriner's Model T unit, with its two full-size tin Lizzies chased by a fleet of madcap miniatures. By mid-afternoon, the crowd was gravitating to the community center, where Prime Minister Jakobsdottir was the featured speaker. We had some of our state politicians on the stage, which kind of slowed things down, but Master of Ceremonies Curtis Olofsson owned the podium, and Ryan Taylor jollied up the crowd with some rope tricks. When Her Excellency rose to speak, she received a standing ovation. When she concluded, there was another standing ovation. Twice, the full house rose to its feet, and I mean with enthusiasm. So what did she say? If our own dignitaries on stage listened closely, they heard themselves gently critiqued. Jakobsdottir spoke pointedly about the virtues of consensus government, the need to subsume partisanship and serve the public interest. She spoke with pride of her nation's record in human rights and gender equality. She boasted of her administration's efforts toward conservation and of her people's environmental consciousness. Prime Minister Jakobsdottir invoked her own scholarly study of crime fiction in Icelandic literature, thus posing the ideal of a learned leadership. And she warmed to the subject of our common cultural ties across the North Atlantic, ties of immigration and of immigrants, maintaining sympathies and culture from the old country. As if to emphasize her point, following the speeches, a gentleman brought the piano to life and led the crowd in a stirring rendition of a favorite Icelandic anthem, Visur Islendinga, by Jonas Hallgrímsson. Hval ertsfo glatnem gura fina fundur. What is so joyful as a gathering of good friends? I know I butchered that line, but give me credit for trying and for sensing what was happening at the time. The air was electric. The pianist swung right into two additional unannounced songs, which took Her Excellency by surprise, but she responded with vigor. She knew the words, and she delivered them. What is so joyful as a gathering of good friends? Perhaps a gathering of good friends reunited, old friends who still know the words.
As Tom Ezern observed, small-town festivals offer lots of traditional attractions, but Mountain's long-running Icelandic festival, August the Deuce, is among the very best. Main Street's Ashley Thornburg traveled to Mountain, population 92, a town that can boast hosting multiple foreign dignitaries, and in true North Dakota spirit, in the most humble way.
In a small-town North Dakota festival, a tractor pull is a given.
27 feet for Jackson. Good job, Jackson.
But this...
Next, we have the Prime Minister of Iceland.
Not so much. Did you catch that? I'll replay it.
Prime Minister of Iceland.
I think every Icelander wants to visit. You know, it's a very popular spot for Icelandic tourists.
Her Excellency Katrin Jakobsdottir is the Prime Minister of Iceland. She came to Mountain, a tiny town in northeastern North Dakota, for the Icelandic Heritage Festival on August the 2nd. It's known as August the Deuce, or more commonly...
The Deuce.
Mountain is home to 92 people, give or take. And while it's sinking in that a foreign dignitary would come thousands of miles to be in a parade, I'll add this. She's not even the first foreign head of state to visit.
This is now our fifth sitting prime minister who has visited our celebration.
And that's just since 1999.
And we've had multiple ambassadors and multiple cabinet ministers.
Curtis Olofsson is the president of the Icelandic Communities Association.
We take great pride in our Icelandic heritage, and it's something that we are really proud of and really passionate about.
He's deep into Icelandic traditions.
Eat all kinds of interesting Icelandic food.
Even the ones a lot of Icelandic Americans, and even some Icelanders, ignore.
Rotten shark and ram's testicles.
He has a theory on why this pipeline between North Dakota and Iceland is so strong.
They so deeply appreciate the work that we do here.
Icelandic immigrants settled in Mountain in the 1870s.
There was a family on every quarter section of land.
And if you go far enough back in any given family tree, it seems everyone's related. Even the prime minister had luck in Mountain.
I've already met actually a few relatives here.
About 3,000 miles separates Mountain, North Dakota from Iceland. But when it comes to cultural connections, there's little separation.
When I first set foot in Iceland and stepped out of the airport terminal, I had this strange and overwhelming sense of calm and a feeling that I was home, and it never left me, and it comes back every time I go.
The Deus celebrates the day in 1874 when a new constitution was introduced for Iceland's independence from Denmark. It's the longest-running ethnic heritage festival in North Dakota, and it's the largest Icelandic heritage festival in the entire United States. The multi-day festival attracts people from across the region and even welcomed about 100 people from Iceland.
I'm Arna Borg from Akureyri. I was born there, but I live in a small town nearby Reykjavik, which is called Garðabær.
What are you doing in Mountain, North Dakota?
I'm just having fun. Well, I have many relatives in Canada and also, of course, here. I've been dreaming about coming here, and, well, I love it. It's always nice to see where your relatives has lived, you know.
In her 10-day visit to northern North Dakota and southern Manitoba, she's been impressed.
It's amazing. I met a man here. He was born here. He must be about 70 years old. He's speaking Icelandic. It's amazing.
August the Deuce is also a day when North Dakotans remind the politicians they work for them. And many elected officials made an appearance.
North Dakota Attorney General Wayne Stengem, Congressman Kevin Kramer.
We welcome them no matter what their politics are.
That's because the politicians and people know that North Dakota and Iceland are similar. Not many people have been to either place. There's lots of land and not many people, but those people are hardworking. And both the United States and Iceland have faced a lot of political turmoil and polarization lately. Prime Minister Jakobsdottir's visit is primarily a friendly one, but she also thinks we can learn from one another.
What we are doing now in Iceland, we have a government that really stretches from the right side of politics to the left side of politics, with three parties, right, center, and left. A political innovation, you could call it that.
And though this festival attracts thousands of people to this little town, it never gets a big head.
It's very humbling.
For Main Street, I'm Ashley Thornburg.
You can see pictures from the 2018 August the Deuce celebration on our Main Street Facebook page. And you can learn more about the event at thedeuce.org. You can hear more from the Prime Minister on our archives page from Monday's show. And Ashley Thornburg is with me right now to talk about this adventurous day she had on Saturday.
And I would have to say that it is probably the most surreal reporting experience that I have ever had. And it just sort of started it when I was reading the forum and I saw the mention of the prime minister coming. And I sort of thought, wait, what? Real prime minister coming to North Dakota? And I remember, like, having grown up in Wahala, hearing years ago that a sitting president had come, and I don't know where that went in my mind, but so I made a bunch of phone calls, and everybody was very busy preparing for the festival, so I wasn't able to get anybody on the phone. I sent some Facebook messages, ended up with the mayor's cell phone, gave him a call. He hooked me up with Curtis Olafsson, the very dedicated president of the Icelandic Communities Association. The things that really stand out to me covering a story like this is just how perfectly North Dakotan this is, because they pooled together these resources, this tremendous access that they have, and this dedication to heritage. And it never really got to anyone's head at all. Everyone just sort of, I mean, they were there. They were very respectful of the prime minister and engaged with many of the politicians who were there. But at the same time, never forgetting about the things like the tractor pull and going to play volleyball and listening to Garth Brooks at the time. And also that you can just get a mayor's cell phone number based on a Facebook message. I found out – well, I didn't actually know in advance if I was going to be able to get the prime minister. I got pulled over on the way to Mountain.
You were in a hurry.
I was in a hurry. Yeah, I got pulled over. I'm sorry. And I drove the speed limit the rest of the way, I promise. Pulled into town with no gas. And there's some parts of North Dakota where getting gas is still sort of difficult.
I think at the top of a mountain you can get
right? And then I just – I mean, you practically just ran into her. I pulled in, grabbed a spot. And I said, well, gee, now how do you go about finding the prime minister? Loudspeaker comes on, and ladies and gentlemen, it's the prime minister. And I thought, well, that was ridiculously easy. And I just walked to the end of the parade route at the end of the parade, and there she was. And I was able – I mean, I just kept expecting some – level of, hey, who are you?
Did you expect some dark dressed Icelanders with things in their ears?
Or you know, maybe a county sheriff, you know, or something like that.
Well, she's from a small country.
She is.
She's used
to
mixing it up with the people. I mean, Iceland, from all of my understanding of it, is a pretty informal place.
It is a pretty informal place, but still, it was a head of state. You'd think that would kind of go away. But, you know, there's that same, you know, that wonderfully the North Dakotan ability to trust that good people will do the right thing. And I just was able to go up and chat with her. And I just, over and over, I thought, is this really happening?
And this is Katrín Jakob's daughter, reminding us that, of course, Iceland is a great big family. She's a daughter of somebody.
and she found her own relatives in Mountain. I couldn't believe it.
Well, don't a lot of Icelanders come to Mountain?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there were more than 100 who attended this event. And it actually, Mountain, North Dakota, is one of the most popular destination places for Iceland. Well, that in Gimli, Manitoba.
I have a great friend who is Icelandic by heritage, and you know him as well. And we always joke about the fermented shark. Obviously, they weren't serving that in Mountain because no one was going to buy it.
No.
So what food, what Icelandic food did you like?
I bought a whole big old bag of Kleiner, their donuts, and I did not. I don't even think they made them all the way to the car with me. I ate them so fast. They're delicious donuts. They had oh, boy, I'm going to butcher all the pronunciation. But they definitely had a lot of sort of that, the pastry and the pannekaker and things like that.
And you had a tiny town
absolutely
filled with people.
Yes, absolutely. Like you do not see this many people in Mountain or really in that northeast corner of the state.
So
ever.
it sort of pays to pay attention to your heritage and celebrate your traditions.
Yeah, and in fact, the church there is the oldest established Icelandic church that is still in operation. It really is a rich heritage that I think people have glossed over because they think, small town, what could possibly happen? And I'm here to tell you that is the wrong attitude to take.
Well, we're going to have to send you down to the sauerkraut triangle, I think.
Hey, I'll do it.
Yeah. Ashley, Wishick, you know, those places down there, and celebrate that heritage, which is, of course, Germans from Russia.
Absolutely. Just tell me what to eat.
Yeah, just about anything. Ashley Thornburg, thank you.
Oh, my pleasure, Doug.
Coming up next, Natural North Dakota.
It's almost time to set sail for an evening Missouri River cruise aboard the Lewis and Clark Riverboat with Plains Folk essayist Tom Easer. Tom will read and discuss his new book, Pacing Dakota. So join Prairie Public and Tom this Friday, August 10th at the Riverboat Landing off River Road near Keelboat Park in Bismarck. We'll sail from 8 to 9:30 p.m. There will be a cash bar on hand and gorgeous views. Tickets are $35, which you can reserve in advance at prairiepublic.org, or you can get them at the dock the night of the cruise. So we hope to see you Friday at 8 p.m. for an evening August cruise with Tom Easer. Proceeds benefit Prairie Public.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. Join us each month as we engage in philosophical discussions about topics from hunting to domestic violence, from classic works of art to the most cutting-edge digital media. That's Why Radio on this station or online at whyradioshow.org.
That's this Sunday at 5 Central, 4 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Chuck Lura teaches biology at Dakota College at Botano and, of course, writes the Natural North Dakota essays that you hear every week right here on Prairie Public. He looks at the natural world around us and provides some insight. And today, he's looking to the skies to tell about the annual Perseids meteor shower.
When was the last time you took time to really get out and enjoy watching some falling stars? Whatever your timetable, we probably have the best show of the year coming up soon. Plus, the weather might be about as good as it's going to get. We're approaching the peak viewing period of the Perseids meteor shower on the evening of Sunday, August 12th, and into the early morning hours of Monday, August 13th. There'll be a crescent moon setting early that evening, so that'll help tremendously with the viewing. And if the weather's warm, with a cloudless sky, we could be seeing up to 60 meteors per hour during the peak period. We entered the meteor shower back on July 17th. And it should continue until August 24th. The show's expected to increase in intensity until the peak, and then taper off towards the 24th. Falling stars, of course, are not falling stars. They're little pieces of comets. Comets are often described as dirty snowballs consisting of ice, rock, dust, a few miles in diameter. Comets have an orbit, and they heat up as they come near the sun. As a result, small, roughly sand-sized pieces of ice and other material break loose, forming a debris field. Then when the Earth passes through the debris field of a comet during its orbit, some of that debris collides with the Earth's atmosphere and becomes glowing hot. Here on Earth, we call them falling stars, or more accurately, meteors. Meteor showers are named after the constellation from which they appear to originate. So the Perseids meteor shower will appear to originate from the constellation Perseus, even though the meteors may be observed in other areas of the sky. So look to the northeast after midnight. The Perseids are caused by the debris field from a comet, Swift-Tuttle. It's one of the oldest known comets, and references to it can be traced back to records from China around 26 AD. But it wasn't until 1862 that Lewis Swift and Horace Parnell Tuttle discovered that these streaks of light were actually due to a comet. So consider making a point of enjoying the Perseids. Find a dark place, settle into a chair or lie in a blanket, and enjoy the show. I'm Chuck Lara.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Botano. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Coming up this week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, President Jefferson joins us and answers many questions.
On the eve of my annual trip to the Lewis Clark Trail in Montana and Idaho, we had a visitor who said, "More listener questions, please," and we have done exactly that.
We've got a couple of questions about Jefferson and the ocean, one about his ocean voyages.
Comparing John Adams' heroism on the high seas with Jefferson's timidity, Jefferson only was in a ship twice, once going and once coming from France.
We also got some questions about how President Jefferson managed his time so successfully.
Answer: discipline, organization. Never waste a single moment. He who never wastes a single moment will never complain of a want of time, said Jefferson.
And we got a number of corrections, including my error. John Hancock was born in Massachusetts.
Not New York, as we erroneously said.
Sorry about that. Join us for all that and more on this week's Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Sunday at 11 Central, 10 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public. This is Dakota Datebook for August 8th. Bismarck was founded in 1872. In the style of the times, workers hauled in massive amounts of lumber to build the town, creating an expanse of dry wooden buildings. It's no surprise, then, that they finished a volunteer firehouse in 1884. The department had some rudimentary equipment, like a ladder wagon, but they were not prepared for the blaze that flared up on this date in 1898. It all began near the agent's office of the Northern Pacific Railway Station a little before 9 p.m. Someone raised the alarm, but the sharp winds of the prairie fanned the flames across the highly flammable town, wasting no time in demolishing everything in its path. At least two powder kegs exploded inside the large freight warehouse, blowing the roof off. As the fire shot out of control, the wind blew stifling plumes of smoke at the firefighters, burning their eyes. Telephones also went down, so the neighboring town of Mandan didn't know about the fire until they saw a glow on the horizon. They sent in their firefighters to help on a special train. It was 3 o'clock in the morning before the fire was subdued. Unfortunately, it had already ravaged most of the town, taking down businesses like Kuntz's and Juan's Cigar Factory, Penwarden's confectionery shop, most of the grocery stores, and all the drug stores. Some see the bright side of the fire. Modern blogger Randy Hoffman believes it sparked rebirth, stating the fire of 1898 helped propel Bismarck from its shantytown frontier roots. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Lucid Thomas, with credit to Troy Larson of Ghosts of North Dakota. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Everyone's living on social media these days. And hey, so is Prairie Public.
We love when friends come to visit.
Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and
Twitter
at Prairie Public.
They take pictures of themselves, and no surprise, they post them to Instagram.
You'll find television and radio content and behind-the-scenes views of Prairie Public via Facebook Live.
While we're live on Facebook, time for another movie review with Madeline.
Interact by sharing your thoughts, opinions, and photos. Just not your cat photos.
Talk to Prairie Public. We want to hear from you.
President Trump is amping up the pressure on China over trade. Trump unveiled a new round of tariffs this week that would affect billions of dollars worth of Chinese goods.
What you have in China is a lot of concern about where this is going. They're not really feeling a lot of pain today. They're worried about feeling a great deal of pain 6 months from now or a year.
Playing chess with China on the next morning edition from NPR News.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
Thursday on Main Street, more and more people are having difficulty handling their own affairs, so there's an increasing need for guardians. On Thursday, we'll discuss that with David Boyk and Judy DeWitz of the North Dakota Protection and Advocacy Project. Sue Balcom will join us with a discussion about canning, and we'll have our What's Happening calendar of events. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Thursday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.